Hey, this is Max, and welcome to the Ronin System Podcast. We're back again with another special guest episode. This time I have Ali Fayyad. Ali, why don't you give a little bit of intro of yourself?
Hello, Max. Thanks for having me. My name is Ali Fayyad, 39 years old. I'm Middle Eastern background. My family immigrated to the United States in the late 80s, and then I came shortly after that. When I was very young, grew up in New York City, Brooklyn, New York, and at the age of 19, I joined the United States Marine Corps and went on to become an infantryman, and that was in 2002, after STEM 11, shortly in the next year, obviously, and served 4 years during the height of the war in Iraq. And when I got out, when I was discharged, the way military contracts work is 4 years. So depending on the length of contract you have, you would serve 4 or 5 years, 6 years, whatever. Mine was 4. And then you would get out. You would be considered what's called the inactive reserves. And while I was in that, the United States military conducted what's called a surge in Iraq. And I recalled a whole bunch of people back. And I was recalled for another year. So I technically did 5 years. And when I got out of the Marine Corps, went back to New York, went back to school, did some odd schooling. I got like 100 credits of whatever, you know, I need to plus up and have a degree. But from there, in 2009, I was always interested in the journey of executive protection, dignitary protection type, the street term for it, although the society had shied away from it, and now it's more educated on the subject with the bodyguard work, but not really. So more on the executive side, more organized and stuff like that. Started that then, and then did that. I do it till this day now. So I've been in the industry for that long. In 2014, we left New York City, went to Dearborn, Michigan, where I currently have a home, a big Middle Eastern, Lebanese-based community there, the largest in North America outside of the Middle East. Actually, largest in the world outside the Middle East. So moved a mom over there. My sister's there, married, got a niece, and I am not married, don't have any kids. And here we are. And through a friend of mine, a really good friend of mine, Jared Kustani, he mentioned you, Max, and your podcast. I said, I'd be very interested. And here we are.
Okay, cool. So he mentioned you were a Marine as well. And then so I asked him why he got into it, and he basically said, his words, he wasn't good enough for school. But for you specifically, why did you enlist?
Well, I'm going to have to disagree that Jared is not good at school. Jared is very intelligent.
Yeah, he is.
But maybe he just didn't like going to school. You know? It's a big difference. I joined, so to back it up a little bit, my father was killed in Lebanon during the Civil War. And my family members were all around the military. And my grandfather used to work for the water department, and his side hustle was an arms dealer. You know, he traded guns, sold and bought guns, and he would take me with him everywhere. So you could say it was more in my DNA. Like I always knew that I was going to go to the military, or I was going to have a profession that requires me to be around firearms and that sort of thing. And matter of fact, in my eighth grade graduation in junior high school in New York, they call middle school junior high school. In the yearbook, it says what my classmates thought. It says, imagine Ali not joining the army when he grows up. So 9/11 comes around, very emotional for all of us. And I was of age. And then I just went to go join the military. I actually went to see the Army recruiter, and kept going back, and the Army recruiters were either very busy or weren't doing their job. And then there was a big long hallway, officers lined to one another, and the last one was open. I go over there, Marine Corps, and the Marine recruiter, I said, who are you running from? I'm not running from anybody. Said, you want to be a Marine? Sit down. And that's how the journey started. But I always knew I wanted to go to the military, and I'm thankful that I did end up choosing the Marines.
Yeah. That's actually kind of interesting how the Marines had less traffic, I guess, at that time. But I guess the Army is more well known, would you say, maybe?
Well, you know, honestly, you don't know what you don't know at the time. None of them make sense to you because you're not educated on the maybe more today because technology had you know, advanced so much. But, you know, pre 9/11, there was no such thing as a smartphone and a computer. You had to plug in your phone line or go to a library to educate yourself. So you only knew what you knew from either a magazine article or what you watched on a movie, or you spoke to a recruiter. And a recruiter is a salesman, right?
Yeah.
They want to get you in there to their branch because they have numbers. You know, they have a quota to meet. They'll tell you they don't, but they do. And so you don't know. Now you'd be more educated on where you want to go. And the branches had advanced so much in their recruiting patterns, and they kind of they have their targeted base that they go after. Like, for example, special operations maybe would go after D1 athletes or any prospects for that. So they know where they want to go recruit. Not back then. Back then, you walked into the recruiter's office. And so I didn't know. I knew who the Marines were. People know, but you didn't really know. No, you know.
Yeah, I get that. And so, I mean, having been involved in that whole like realm for like pretty much your whole life, I guess, and you're still doing it now. Like that, what'd you call it? The executive. What was the field you said? Executive, so
the industry is known as executive protection.
Executive protection.
Okay. It's a very broad term. And within that, if you cross on the government side or even on the civilian side, because there are dignitaries that employ and seek the services of private companies to do the dignitary protection piece of things. But usually dignitary protection involves a government agency of some sort. The civilian term is executive protection. A lot of these executives in these companies are sometimes board mandated to have a protection team. Some of these programs are within that company, funded and, you know, employed by the company. But majority of it is you have a lot of protection agencies out there who started, developed, and, you know, X individual or X executive travels from one city to another. They'll seek out those services, and not because of a direct threat or anything like that, just so they're not a target of opportunity due to recognition of who they are. And on the productivity side, as many studies were done, that if that certain individual CEO, I think the math was broken down that they did a survey, I think 500 highest paid CEOs in America, and then when they did the math, they broke it down, and these guys make $17,500 an hour when they're working. So when they're not working, they're losing that. So when you get a driver, a security driver is just more than an actual driver. They're, you know, they train on how to drive tactically and all that. And then you get a protection agent with you, and they facilitate your trip from A to Z, from picking you up in the airport to having dinner reservations or meeting reservations for you, and making sure a slew of things get done before you come into town and leave. So you'll have that peace of mind. I'm here. I'm safe. They do the business for me. You know, they protect me and all that good stuff. And I leave for a fee. And that's kind of how it works with companies and individuals who are not assigned or employed by a full-time executive. For example, we'll use Elon Musk, for example. He has a full-time team that's employed by his company. I'm not sure which company they fall under. Microsoft has a full-time team. You know, Bill Gates, Facebook, Zuckerberg has a full-time team. So those guys, that's your constant principal executive that you're always with. Other guys who are in the market would, you know, provide services for whoever solicits and pays for their services.
Okay. So I'd imagine you travel a lot then, right?
Tons of travel. You got to be very flexible. So for initially when I started in New York City for a company called SJC Security, and they did executive dignitary protection. It was started by two retired NYPD detectives. And from there, I went on to do government contracting for the federal government overseas. Exactly what I'm doing, I just get a paycheck from the government. So I'm a third party technically. Why the government does that is because it would be a lot more expensive to hire an actual agent and train them and pay them, and they're going to go on and you got to pay them 401k and all that. It would take too long and it would cost the government too much then just to go outside and solicit these services. But there were parameters in place. You had to be an American citizen. You had to meet a certain background criteria in order to get the job and be vetted and receive what's called a security clearance. And those come in different levels, obviously. So you checked all those boxes. You went to work overseas on behalf of the United States government, but you weren't an employee of the government. You were what's called an independent contractor. And I did that from 2010 all the way to 2017. And then from 17 to now, I've been doing it on the civilian side. So yes, short answer, ton of travel.
Okay. Do you have like on the civilian side, do you have like repeat, like I guess you'd call them customers or clients?
Correct. Clients. The proper terminology is clients. I work for a full-time client. So I'm not out there, connecting and coordinating with different clients and stuff like that. So no, the short answer is no. But I know a lot of friends. I have a lot of buddies and friends in the industry who do work for bigger name, companies. And these clients, these customers, seek the services of such company. And these companies usually have a lot of agents on staff in their database in different states. Say, for example, right now, Max, you want to go, you're in North Carolina and you want to go to Georgia, for example. You look up a certain, EP company, and then you'll, email them, call them, whatever. Be like, hey, I got a travel itinerary next Thursday to Sunday. I need security. And usually when these people call, they don't know what they want. So it's your job to explain to them what they really need. Then they'll conduct an interview with them. This is where you're going. Okay, how long are you staying? Is there anything you're concerned about? Or this is just, protocol, you want to feel safe type because you heard Atlanta was dangerous, whatever. So yes, those guys will see a lot of rinse and repeat clients if they like them or new clients.
Okay. And so I'd imagine, my only reference for this would be you and Hollywood. So I'd imagine it's definitely nothing like Hollywood, right? It's got to be pretty. I mean, I'm assuming it's definitely a high stress position, like a high stress job. But I wouldn't imagine it's like every single day you're worried about something, right?
Well, so some very few Hollywood gigs get it correct, and okay. That's with every profession, with everything.
Yeah, for Hollywood. Sure.
Because when Hollywood makes sense, it's got to be watchable, right? It can't be boring.
Yeah, so yeah, for sure.
The intensity is there, depending on who you're protecting, what detail you're assigned to, where they are in the world is what dictates that stress level, and what is required to protect such individual. For example, protecting a celebrity is a lot more stressful than protecting maybe a company executive that's low key kind of, if we properly use the terminology, because those guys are, they're known. The celebrity is a very known individual. Paparazzis follow you everywhere, so on and so forth. Where an executive is, if you really don't know who they are, you don't know who they are, which is amazing. The risk, the threat is, the protection package is usually threat driven. Threat. And so is there a threat? And that's how, you plus up plus up or down on your protection package and kind of dictate what can happen, what cannot happen. So it's all threat-based, threat-driven. What is going on with that individual? What do we need to protect them? Who are we protecting them from? So there's a lot of stuff that go on in the background side of things in the house just to figure out what is going on. Who is this individual or individuals that want to hurt your principal, your protectee? And but I'll tell you, 99% of the time, there's nothing there, right? What you don't want to do is become collateral to something that might happen near you or in the surrounding area that you're in, because nothing geared towards that certain principal. Or depending on who your client is and who your principal is, there's usually someone upset about something, right? These people are in high positions and someone somewhere is upset about something, and a lot of their public engagements is pre-announced. So that individual that's looking to do them harm, or maybe not, has already a time and place to plan against, and things of that sort. But a lot of people just want the protection for peace of mind. They're going to Baltimore. Yeah, for sure. Well, nothing against Baltimore, but, well, you know, high crime areas, and be like, hey, my family would feel better. I would feel better.
Yeah, yeah, that's totally understandable. So with that, I mean, I'd assume you're well trained and you're very good at spatial awareness. And I think Jared did also mention you have a school, right?
Correct. So after coming back from overseas, before, you know, trying to figure out which direction I'm going to head, I started a firearms training business. It never really expanded much. The funding wasn't all there. The venues in Michigan at the time weren't very receptive of the idea. I didn't have capital to start like my actual brick and mortar place. So it was more by like appointment or, you know, referrals and all that. And so I did that part time and then until I got back into the field of working. But how I met Jared was a friend of mine that I worked with in overseas dual protection. He was on my team. I was his team leader. He called me up one day around right before COVID, and he says, hey, I work for a company that does firearms training and firearms simulated training. Would you be interested? I says, and I don't think it's my type of thing. And he told me more about it, and I got on with them for a little bit. That's how I met Jared. And then from there, I was getting executive protection offers all over the country. I went out to California for a little bit, did not like that, came back, and there was more offers. And there was offers to go back overseas, which I didn't want to do. And then I landed my full-time gig now, which I'm really happy with. It went from there. But the training, yeah, so this industry attracts, I would say 95% of the industry is former military or law enforcement. Kind of gears that way, you know. The skill set, the training, the firearms training piece of it, even though a lot of details are unarmed. But the certain individual that joins the military, becomes a police officer, and does stuff like that, it's kind of already geared more towards that. And they usually, a lot of times, end up doing some sort of a protection, working on a protection detail or having a training while they were still as in the military or law enforcement. So the skill set is there. They don't know how to do anything else. And you know, it's attractive, the work, it's easy in a way. So that's where the biggest pool in the industry is from. And then the other 5% is whoever. And then, to be fair to everyone in the industry, as some of the best practitioners I've ever came across and worked with were neither police officers or military. They were straight up civilians who were, you know, attracted to the field work and the job and the career field. And they went and got the training and moved on and became very good practitioners. But initially, right out the door, if you want to become an executive protection agent, you have to go to a school. And an accredited nationally accredited executive protection school. They go from 3 days to 3 weeks, you know, to a month, and that involves what an executive protection agent does. You know, they'll teach you tactical driving, they'll teach you a little bit of defensive tactics and how to plan and execute protection details, the do's and don'ts. How do you protect someone? Basically, what it boils down to. So the better your background, the better the gigs are open to you. For example, if you are from the special operations community, Green Beret, Navy SEAL, Marine Raider, Air Force, you know, TACP, PJ, whatever, any of those sexy jobs in the military, there's another whole slew of protection work only open to you because of your background in the military. You have proven to be a, you know, top notch individual that can endure a lot of, you know, adversity and survive, and the training was so hard and you survived. So it already tells a lot about you. And they get some maybe better contract work. And then it's like anything in life, you know, how good you are, what doors are open for you. And if you're just a brand new individual going into the industry, you're going to get some very low level work, make those connections, you know, network, prove yourself, and then hopefully one day you land on a good detail, stay there, or start your own.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm just imagining like the firearms training portion of it. it's mainly obviously about the firearms, but is there any sort of like, I heard you mention like unarmed combat. Is there any portion of it where there's like sort of like close quarters training or anything?
Yeah. So are you, I mean, part of being an executive protection agent or a protector, the biggest part of the job is to protect someone. So you gotta be sure. Physically able to protect that individual or individuals. Defensive tactics, honestly, is not really laid on heavy in the industry as they should. I think they should do way more with that. But firearms depends on where you are and license. And this is all, I'm speaking civilian, you know, on the civilian side of things. Government, obviously, your government, you work for the government agency, you're allowed to do that, and you're on a government detail, different set of rules, different ballgame completely. But as a civilian practitioner, it depends on where you are in the country, what licenses you have in place, and are you able to carry in that state or in that jurisdiction, or are you not? But I'll go ahead and tell you right now that a huge chunk of the industry does not carry on these details. You can solicit those services in cities that you go to if you feel like you need an armed detail, because a firearm is a liability. You can't just go around, brandishing your firearm or shooting people.
Yeah, for sure.
No one will hire you ever again, and then you'll have a ton of problems with the government, with the law on your hands. So the best protection plan is to never have to either fight anyone, draw your gun, or shoot anyone. That means you've done your homework, what's called an assessment, a threat assessment before you go, or an area assessment, venue assessment. You know, the terminology varies from detail to detail, state to state, practitioner to practitioner, but they're all kind of the same, right? So if you do your homework very well as an executive protection agent and your team, you never have to do any, you never have to fight anyone, you never have to shoot anyone, you can completely avoid it, right? But if you happen to be in a situation where you need to use that stuff, you need to be ready and able and capable to do that.
Okay. Yeah, the reason I ask is specifically for not just like the firearms, but also for like close quarters, is that I'm a jiu-jitsu black belt. I've been doing it for like 15 years. I've been doing martial arts for even longer than that. But like a very common thing I get asked is like, what would I do in a self-defense situation? And this, you know, obviously is a much larger aspect of it where you're actually protecting someone else along with yourself. But people always ask me, or like they just sort of assume a lot of times that I would use my jiu-jitsu and like my grappling experience as my main point of self-defense. And, you know, I do have like very base level firearms training. I've concealed carry before, mainly just in handguns, pistols, but I never actually carry anymore. I didn't like to. It was a weight, and I'd rather go into regular life with the mindset of like, if you're like, I wouldn't do anything with the gun if I didn't have the gun. You know what I mean? Like,
right. So I understand. I respect that. So that's awesome that you are a jiu-jitsu black belt. So the industry attracts a lot of people who end up going out and seeking their own training. And a big part of the training is Brazilian jiu-jitsu, as you already know. Why? The idea with executive protection and the executive protection agent is, yes, to be able to be skilled in a self-defense style, and preferably jiu-jitsu, as it has been for a long time now, to be able to, you know, get their principal protected and disengage from that individual that wants to attack them, but not really hurt them so much unless they really need to. But the idea is not to sit there and grapple that individual. If you have a team and you need to hold that person there for a little bit while they take your principal protectee client away from the problem, fine. Okay. But most of the time when you're working with these executives, depending on the venue you go to and what's going on, it's probably just you or one other person, right? So the idea is to get them away from you and your principal, of course, and then keep it moving, keep going. If you happen to find yourself on the ground with this individual or standing, going toe-to-toe, possibly. But you don't want to stay there, because if you're sitting there grappling this individual and fighting them, whatever, who's protecting the boss and who's taking care of that problem? Like I said, unless there's another individual. And that also goes into planning you have to plan for all of that. Like, you literally have to plan for every single step you take into the venue and make sure none of that will happen. Again, if you did your homework, that wouldn't happen unless you're there and it happened with someone else and somehow, some way you guys got wrapped up, or what's called a target of opportunity, your principal, someone was seen there and, you know, they recognize them and they want to attack them for whatever reason. The probability is very low. But yes, it would come down to a close quarter, you know, very tight space. What do I do here? But the idea is to get out of trouble quickly and leave quickly, which you should have a plan for that. Right. So you want to, kind of the acronym goes, or how I would do it, is you want to plan for attack, medical, fire, power, a venue loses power, and just, you know, ordinary. Like, we just want to leave. You know, your principal, boss, they just want to leave. They're uncomfortable. They want to leave. So you plan for all that, and you do what's called, there's a term out there called protective intelligence, where you do cyber analysis on your boss and your client and your protectee, and you find out who's saying what out there about this individual. Do they want to hurt them? Do they want to kill them? Do they know what they're doing? What city? So, you know, all that comes together. But a big piece of the job is being physically able and capable. And a ton of people, including a lot of friends of mine, I do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I did very, very, very briefly. You can't even count it, right? And I didn't anymore. And I need to go back. And I would go back. But they all do it. Most of us do it, you know, between firearms and some sort of hand-to-hand protection style that you should learn and would learn.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was going to say also that I would never actually use jiu-jitsu unless absolutely, it would probably be my last resort. It's the thing. Like, right. in those situations, like, from just giving it thought, I would probably be like diffuse and disengage, like you just said, you know, try and get away from there as soon as possible. But
couldn't have said it better.
Yeah.
Use and disengage.
Yeah. And I'm also of the mindset where I don't, like, having done jiu-jitsu for long enough and having actually been in not super life-threatening situations, but having been in self-defense situations in the past, the reason I wouldn't use jiu-jitsu is because it is like a one-on-one kind of thing, you know, like, especially in a case where if there's multiple attackers or multiple sort of variables, then it causes more issues for you, especially because jiu-jitsu is so heavy in the ground, you know, there's a lot of ground grappling.
Right.
But I mean, for me personally, I prefer something more along the lines of judo, which in this area in North Carolina, there is not a lot. So
right.
I'm kind of forced to do jiu-jitsu.
Right.
Just because it's a lot easier, in my opinion, to trip someone or toss them to the side. Even if they don't go to the ground, you're, you know, putting them off balance enough to either get away or take up another opportunity to do whatever you need to do. Right. So
correct.
I think that's the better option. And especially because, you know, most people aren't going to be walking around like with no clothes on. So
right.
in
right.
jiu-jitsu, like, you know, no gi, like there's nothing to grab onto. But in right. real life, you have something to grab onto. In judo, you don't need something heavy duty like a jacket like most people think. You can use a shirt. You can use like pants suspenders. You can use a scarf. You can use whatever you want as long as you get a single grip and good timing, you can get that person off balance or even on the ground and get out of there. So I think judo is a much better option, coupled with some sort of striking, boxing, Muay Thai, something like that, just in case, you know?
Yeah, I was going to tell you, Muay Thai is amazing, but then you got to understand the liability piece of it, you know, you're people and all that. But you're absolutely right. The industry terminology is they call you want to get off the X, and the X is where the problem happens. All right, whether you're driving, whether you're walking, whether you're fighting, you want to get off the X. Because if you remain on the X more, it becomes a shit sandwich, right?
Yeah.
You want to leave. So you have these pre-identified exits from your venue, if you're in a venue, or when you plan your routes to driving, you have a primary, secondary, tertiary, and an emergency route, up to four routes you can plan. On all that good stuff, you know, where to park, maybe park an emergency vehicle on a venue, maybe to leave out the backside. You're going to what's called an advancing a venue before you go to it almost 100% of the time. If you're able to, sometimes you're not, as an ad hoc move and you got to go, which maybe if you have enough personnel, push in front of the motorcade a little bit, or the cars that are traveling, just to get eyes on, you know, just to get there and make sure that the place is not on fire.
Yeah, just scout the place out.
Yeah, exactly. So you would do all that, find out, you know, all that stuff. And even in the area that you're going to, you'd find out like the medical emergency capabilities of that area. Is there a level one trauma hospital, and how close is it? How far it is? You know, what's the response time for emergency personnel in that area? Is it a New York City, a heavy traffic, heavy congested area, or is it a 3-minute response time? If I'm in trouble, you know, how long are they do they need to come? All that good stuff. All that goes into your planning piece. If you're someone who is a professional and do your homework.
Yeah, for sure. So what's that saying? It's like an ounce of preparation over a pound of cure, something like that.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, they say yeah, along those lines. I've heard it said in many different ways. But yeah, absolutely, man. Hey, prepare. And like I said, they you know, if a successful detail is a boring detail, right? Boring is good in this job. You always want to be bored in this job. But I don't want the term to be misconstrued. Boring, not doing your job, and you're not paying attention. You're not a professional. You have to always be remain a professional. And in this job, perception becomes your reality 100%. Right? How you are perceived becomes your reality. You want to be a hard target. You want to look like you know what you're doing, kind of on your game. But you want a boring detail. You want nothing to happen. You want them to come in, do their thing, or go. If you're a full-time detail, go execute business. Like second to none. You also want to, like, not kind of not like you mentioned Hollywood earlier. You don't want like to be the movies where you're all over them and they're not the president of the United States. The bubble has to be loose a little bit more. But you want them to, they want to live their life. They want to be regular, normal humans. So you have to know how to strike that balance of how do I still be effective, you know, protector, practitioner, and still let them be normal. You know, now you're not breathing down their neck. You're not all over them. You're making it look weird and. You know, attracting unwanted eyes and attention and still be able to do it. And that comes with experience and time. Sort of kind of like in your world, the black belt jiu-jitsu, you can tell a white belt from a black belt, or even blue belt, you know, brown belt, you know, on the floor, on the ground, on the mat, what are they doing versus a black belt, brown belt? Obviously, that experience is there. It's exactly the same thing, just in a protection piece of things.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's kind of like giving your clients kind of like a, I don't want to say loose leash, because leash seems wrong.
Right. Yeah. It depends on where you are, who they are, where you are, what they're doing. Right. For example, if we're walking through a very crowded area, I'm a lot closer than if we're on a beach.
Yeah.
Right? If we're walking. So you kind of have to know where you are, what you're doing, what's happening. It's sort of like that.
Yeah. Totally get that. So yeah, it's nothing like the movies.
No, not at all. Like
when you said the executive protection thing, the first thought, maybe it's because I'm getting a lot of ads on it on like my devices and stuff, but like the first thought was like John Wick.
Yes. Oh, so okay. Well, no, not really. John Wick is out there just handling business.
He's the opposite, someone, you know.
Someone missed. If I wanted to give you some good movies to relate to executive protection,
Man of Fire with Denzel Washington.
Yeah, exactly. That's a one. It's a great movie, by the way. One of my favorite.
It is 100%. Fantastic movie.
I mean, it's Denzel, right? So Man on Fire is a big one. And there isn't an actual movie strictly for executive protection, but there are a lot of clippings of different movies that kind of portray it correctly a little bit. I'll text you a list, and you can check them out. I'll send you different clippings, but yeah. And some get it right. Some are, you know, over exaggerated. But if it's done correctly, honestly, you don't notice it. You shouldn't notice it, right? Unless it's someone super, super high profile and TMZ's following everywhere. But other than that, you just another person coming and going.
Yeah, you got to make it, you know, consumable for the general populace. You know?
Very much so. Very much so. Because like, who are you type, you know?
Yeah.
You don't want to be that agent or that protector, or that, you know, that company, because you become overbearing and nobody would want to work with you or receive you on their venue, and you just become a nuisance. And they're like, no. And then you'll just mess things up for you, and you'll never get another client again.
Yeah. let's see. What are you doing on time? All right, I think we're looking good. We can we can wrap it up here and probably follow it with the second one if you want to.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I got time.
Yeah. So, got any closing remarks, Ali?
Honestly, just a big highlight. There aren't a lot of, at least I have not yet met any Middle Eastern Arab American backgrounds who do my job, done my job in the military like I did or in the industry. So if you're out there listening, I would love to meet you. Shoot me a message so you can tell me your journey along the lines. Because having a second, being fluent in a second language that you're able to read and write as well and relate to a culture also does help a lot.
Yeah, actually, so you said you're from Lebanon, right?
Family, correct, yes.
Okay, so do they speak Arabic or is there like a Lebanese?
Yes, the entire Middle East speaks Arabic. They just speak different dialects of Arabic.
Okay, so there's like Lebanese Arabic, but there isn't like a Lebanese
There's a Lebanese dialect. Okay. So the Arabic is a little weird because everybody reads and writes Arabic exactly the same, right?
Yeah.
Modern standard. But everybody speaks it entirely different. That's why it's one of the hardest languages in the world.
Yeah, it's the same thing with Chinese. I'm Chinese, and there are two main languages, Mandarin and Cantonese. Mm-hmm. They don't sound very similar, but they write pretty much the exact same. So yeah, like the written language for most, if not all of Chinese dialects is the same. But then there's like 50 to 60, I don't know, like probably like 100 different dialects across China and across the world. So it's like variations.
Right. So it's kind of along the same lines of that.
Yeah. All right. So we'll close it out here and then we'll follow up with probably a part two with Ali. But if you guys like what you heard and you want to hear more, I got a link tree. You can go to get all those social links there. Did you have a social media or anything that you wanted to like provide?
So with me, I'm with Jared on the Champions Path. So we got that link tree going so we could. You know, you can follow us there. It's still forming and it's coming. I can definitely send you the link to that.
I got it. I'll include it in the episode description.
Okay. Yeah. So perfect. So you can definitely throw it in there.
All right. Perfect. All right, guys. Thank you for listening. Get out there, get hungry, and good luck.